This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
By the way, do you think, with all this copyright stuff, do you think Kurt Cobain himself would have cared if people were playing his music?
Absolutely not. No, I don't think he would have. You know, Metallica really went fucking ape shit on, you know, people. Yeah, exactly. No, I don't think Kurt would have. I don't think he would have gone down that road at all. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because he feels sort of like family now after doing this and talking to so many of his friends and family over the past year, which I know sounds weird when you're talking about a celebrity, but, you know, it's kind of funny.
Are you a Nirvana fan?
You know, I kind of went, I was a Nirvana fan in 92, 93, and then I sort of gravitated towards the East Bay pop punk scene, and then that's been my scene for, you know, 30 years, but I can't deny that Nirvana was kind of my first foray into, I mean, I feel like Kurt himself is super punk rock, you know, he has the entire ethos. Incesticide to me sounds like a pop punk album, and so, you know, and then I, you know, kind of weave back and forth, and then as I got interested in this, I revisited my Nirvana kind of roots, and yes, so that was a very long way of saying that yes, I am a Nirvana fan.
Yeah, I was saying to you just before we started recording, I kind of was a Nirvana fan. They were very popular, but I was more into the punk scene in the early 90s. Okay. So, I mean, I agree with you. Kurt was pretty punk rock. And in fact, a lot of his influences were punk rock.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I think Nirvana pretty much was the only grunge band that existed.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, he could obviously write pop punk because you look at, like, you know, Sliver and those are just pop punk songs. You know, but I think he obviously knew that grunge was a burgeoning scene. You know, he's friends with Sonic Youth and Mudhoney and all those guys. So I feel like, you know, he went that way, but he could have easily done that sort of more, you know, pop punk that you and I kind of fell in love with. I mean, I don't really think he would have gone the route of like Fat Records, but yeah, he definitely had that bend, and things like saying he wasn't going to do Lollapalooza, you know, there are just all those things that I feel like if you didn't have that punk rock ethos, you just wouldn't have done that, you know. So
Michelle, who killed Kurt?
Well, the witness that's there alleges that his friend Dylan Carlson took Kurt up to the greenhouse, and he was there with another guy. We don't know who that person is. However, those two, we believe, gave Kurt a hot shot and then shot him.
Okay, so let's go back a little bit now. Right, so the official story is that he shot himself.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so you're saying that that's not the case.
Exactly. So let me walk you through what happens when Kurt's up in the greenhouse. And this isn't, you know, this isn't hearsay. This is what we see in the crime scene photos that were released in 2014 on the 20th anniversary of Kurt's death. So they released, you know, 15, 20 photos. A lot of them were just of the police kind of standing around, you know, not doing much. But the things that we do see in these photos, so one of the things we see is a cigar box that is out of reach from Kurt's body. The cigar box contains Kurt's, what we assume or presume to be Kurt's needles, some black tar heroin, a spoon, a few little items like that. So here's what the police want you to believe happened. He's up there. He writes a suicide note. The suicide note is, you know, written, and then there are four lines added to the bottom that don't really look like Kurt's handwriting, but they say that's because at the end he decided, okay, fuck it, I'm going to kill myself. Okay, I'm done, and writes the last four lines. We'll talk about the suicide note a little bit more later, suicide note. And then he sits down with no chair, nothing. He just sits down in the middle of the floor, and he does more heroin than they had ever seen anyone else in Seattle do. Now, Seattle in the 90s was a hotbed of addiction. They were seeing heroin addicts, you know, die left, right, and center. I think it's about 68% of addicts are found dead with a needle still in their arm if they, you know, when they take sufficiently enough, or very, very close. So Kurt is found with no tourniquet. He's found with the needles put away in the box. Very clean, very put away. Now, imagine right now, if I gave you two needles and asked you to put the caps on them, as a sober person awake, that would you know, it might be a little challenging. You'll get it done, but it might be challenging to do. As somebody who was on more heroin than anyone had ever seen, why do you then take your, you don't, you know, you do a needle in one, in each arm, at least two needles, because there's too much heroin in the system for one. Then you put the needles back in the box, you cap the needles, you roll down at least one sleeve, button it up, move the box away from you, sit in the middle of the floor, grab your shotgun that was very likely a little bit too long for you to even reach the trigger of, put it in your mouth and end your life. Now, the time distance and the thought between doing all of that, I mean, nobody is found with their kit put away. Nobody is found with caps back on the needles or the sleeve of their shirt. I can't, with one finger, I couldn't probably button this up right now. I mean, you know, it depends whether you're left or right-handed, and Kurt was ambidextrous, but, you know, there are some very, very odd things about his death scene, and that's where I think we all went, well, this warrants further investigation.
Okay, so that was one of the smoking guns. There were a few of them.
Yes, absolutely. So my favorite one is, Kurt had a very, very long shotgun, and it was facing up so that the trigger would have been up. So they're saying he had his hand on the shotgun here and that he used his right hand to pull the trigger.
Hold on. Sorry. Had he already had that gun, was he a gun owner?
So he was a gun owner. So what had happened was Kurt liked to shoot, I mean, never anything live, but he would go shooting, you know, targets, and he liked to have guns. He was interested in them. He also was very concerned about his family's safety. So, you know, about a year prior, Mia Zapata from the Gits had been raped and murdered. And, you know, where he was living in Lake Washington, the house didn't have any gates. There was no security. And, you know, sometimes people would just walk up there. So he was very concerned with whether, you know, he could keep his wife and his daughter safe in the house. So yes, he had had guns. And a month prior to this happening, there was an incident where his wife, Courtney, called the police and said that Kurt was suicidal. He was in the bathroom. He had a gun, and she was scared he was going to take his own life. So the police come. Kurt's outside, and he gets in the police car, very nice, very sober. He says, no, the guns are in the closet. I didn't have the gun in the bathroom, and I'm not suicidal. And Courtney, it is in the police record, she admitted that she lied, that he wasn't in the bathroom with the gun. However, they did confiscate his guns. So, you know, about a month prior to his death, he no longer had any guns. So we don't know how he got the gun. It's said that, so his friend Dylan, the one who is alleged to have been part of the murder conspiracy, went with Kurt to buy a gun. And Kurt said he couldn't buy them because his other guns got confiscated, and he asked Dylan to buy the gun for him. And that was right before Kurt went to rehab. So we're talking about, you know, 5-6 days before we believe Kurt died. But the thing about that is that the only person to vouch for that is Dylan Carlson. And we know that he was, you know, we believe he was involved in the murder plot. So that's where we go, well, was Kurt there? Now, the gun shop owner has stated that someone who may have looked similar to Kurt was there. But again, we're not like, did you recognize Kurt Cobain or not? Because a lot of the guys that were hanging out at that time, you know, they're all wearing flannel. Do we know whether or not that was Kurt? We don't have any, you know, any concrete evidence that Kurt ever did buy the gun. But assuming he did buy the gun, it was a Remington shotgun. He loaded it with birdshot, which is very common for people to do protecting their homes and their families because birdshot doesn't go through the wall. So, you know, if you have someone come into your house and you have this giant shotgun and you're like, you know, get the fuck out of my house, you have a giant shotgun, they're going to be scared. And if it goes off, you're probably not going to kill anybody, you know, accidentally. You're very likely not even going to kill the perpetrator, but, or whoever may be in your house. So it's, you know, it's very widely believed that Kurt did buy the shotgun for protection. Kurt's friend Dylan also said that, yes, Kurt bought this shotgun for protection. If I had thought he was buying it to commit suicide, I never would have bought it for him. So that's where we you know, we've got these valid questions. And I think some people think, well, he bought the shotgun, you know, a week before he died. That sounds to me like somebody who was going to kill themselves. But we have to remember that Kurt was paranoid, and Kurt was a big celebrity and was worried about the safety of his family. So we don't, you know, whether Kurt bought it or not, we don't think it was with intent to kill himself.
Was Courtney a bit loose-ended?
Oh my gosh. The stories about Courtney, she, you know, pardon me. That's putting it mildly. You know, she has, you know, there are many, many police reports talking about people she has threatened, abused, hit. We know that she hit Kurt, you know, she verbally abused Kurt. And, you know, it's interesting because I think if we were in a situation where it had been the woman who had died and, you know, if the roles were reversed, there may have been a different investigation because the abuse of Kurt Cobain was very widely known. So it was physical, it was mental. And then, you know, in her prior marriage, she murdered the family cat and dog. That was, she's an animal abuser as well. Yeah, so her previous husband went to work one day and came home and the cat and dog were both dead. And she was acting like it was nothing and she had killed them. So, he wrote that in his book. And we know that she's been an animal abuser for a long time. So, I mean, I don't know. Does that read serial killer to you? You know, just putting that out there. But
she certainly was pretty unstable.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's not, you know, if we were talking about someone who, you know, someone that we all know and have seen for 20, 30 years who seems like a lovely human being, it would be I think a more difficult investigation. But if you put her history of animal abuse, human abuse, and, you know, just a lot of the things she said, which she loves to write off as just, oh, that's just me. It's like Alice Cooper's stage act. You're like, oh, that's just Alice when he's on stage. You know, Courtney has said she's killed Kurt at least a dozen times. So she said it on stage. She said it on Twitter. I'll put a bullet in your head like I put a bullet in Kurt's. You know, she has said that many times, but no one ever, well, we take her seriously, but lots of people don't take her seriously because that's just Courtney. But yes, she's a wildly unstable human being.
Now, did she love Kurt? And what was Kurt's relationship with the newborn? I mean, they just had a child.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I don't think she loved Kurt. I think she loved herself and loved money and loved fame. And I believe that she gaslit Kurt from the moment she met him. She knew enough about his likes, you know, like he was into punk, you know, he loved the Sex Pistols. She tried to make herself as much like Nancy Spungen as she kind of could. You know, she knew how to manipulate. And I think that's what she did right from the get-go. And then 4 months in, she got pregnant with Francis. And Kurt was, you know, he was the type, he would never leave his child. You know, that was not something that they certainly weren't planning to have a baby. So in my opinion, that feels like he got trapped into something that he didn't want to be in. He adored Frances. No one, his beautiful girl, no one has ever questioned how much Kurt loved his daughter. And so then again, you go, does Kurt want his daughter's last image of him to be his head blown off? Because who doesn't think about that? So, you know, we also know that at the time Kurt wanted a divorce. And, you know, so then he knows how abusive Courtney is. Is he leaving his daughter to fend for herself with Courtney, his beautiful little girl? You know, that has also raised a lot of questions. But yes, he adored Francis.
So let's go back to the gun. I was going to say smoking gun.
Yes.
It was facing the wrong direction.
It was. So the gun is facing the wrong direction. So like I said, you know, it was lying and it was perfectly lying on his chest. So you have to imagine he has a shotgun. And if you've ever looked at photos of shotgun suicides, it is messy business. This is no joke. So, you know, and, you know, we've got a recoil, right? So he's supposedly holding it with one hand and pulling the trigger with the other. So
yeah, it's awkward. It's
very awkward. In the autopsy report, the medical examiner said he believed Kurt was sitting up to shoot the gun and would have flown back like that. What actually has happened, we know because of the bullet trajectory, the pellet trajectory in the brain, is Kurt was lying down and the gun was sort of pointing forward because it took out his frontal lobes. So we know that we're doing some gun testing right now to see if that's even possible for Kurt, who was 5'8", 5'9", to reach the trigger in that position that we know it would have had to be in. So we do have a replica of the shotgun, and we are doing some testing with a few different, we'll say, models who are around Kurt's size. But, you know, my favorite part is the fact that the exit chamber is to the right, exactly to the right, and the shotgun shell is found up and to the left. So Kurt had his brown corduroy jacket kind of up to the left of him, and that shell is there. So you're talking some real magic bullet, you know, situation here, magic shell, as it were. Now, when the case was reinvestigated in 2014, there was a detective named Mike Szyzinski who did the reinvestigation, and he claims that he asked the Seattle police armorer, Kurt Wilson, how did that shell get over there when the exit chamber is on the other side? He claims Kurt Wilson told him that the gun must have flipped in midair as Kurt. I know, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's insane. And we have not spoken with Kurt Wilson directly, but we do know an author who spoke with him. And Mr. Wilson says he never said that. And he was not happy that he was portrayed as saying that.
Okay, wait. So the shotgun spun 180 degrees.
Yes.
After he landed, shot
yes, perfectly. And landed perfectly on his chest, still in his hand.
No, man.
It's amazing. Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
That was the end point, because we can go back and forth and discuss whether we think Kurt was suicidal. We can go back and forth and talk. I mean, you know punk rock. You know that people, Blink 182, Green Day, they all talk about killing themselves 1,000 times more than Kurt. Kurt actually never really talked about suicide in music, but look at some of the bands we listen to, suicidal tendencies. I mean, people like to say, well, he was suicidal, listen to his music.
Okay, but let's play devil's advocate, Michelle. Mm-hmm. He did come across as extremely depressed. He hated what appeared to be the music industry. He wore shirts about killing himself.
So he... you know, I would say that, yes, he did hate the music industry, and I think that any good punk rocker would. I think he did lighten up in the last maybe year of his life where, you know, he was kind of understanding now how things worked and you know, a little bit more accepting of his fame. But a lot of that is just what the media wanted us to think. They would do a whole photo shoot and pick the photos of Kurt where he wasn't smiling. If you actually go back in and type Kurt Cobain smiling in Google, there are tons of photos of him smiling and happy. They love that image of Kurt, you know, so that was something that Courtney and the media helped create. And, you know, the shirt that said, I hate myself and I want to die, that was a joke. And when asked about it, you know, he said he had considered calling In Utero, I hate myself and I want to die. And when the press asked him about it, they said, how serious were you being? And he said, you know, it was as literal as a joke can be. It was just a joke. Like, you know, in the 90s, you know, I grew up in the 90s. And so you're right. So, you know, we were all, that was Gen X. That's what we're like. We're always joking about killing ourselves. You know, it's a, oh, God, just kill me. I can't go to work today. Just, I mean, it's a joke. I'm the least suicidal person. And mark that just in case I ever get killed, because I am not suicidal. But, you know, but we just joke about that.
Okay, so there isn't, are you saying that there isn't much evidence that Kurt was suicidal?
I'm saying there was no evidence that he was ever suicidal. He stated after, so he had some stomach issues that did clear up in about the last year and a half of his life. He did say when someone asked him, he said, yes, I was suicidal because of the stomach pain. Now, I think that, again, anyone who's had migraines or chronic illness, you know, would probably say that, I mean, there are a lot of people who wouldn't, because a lot of people like to stay optimistic, but Kurt had he definitely wasn't, you know, he's not out there bouncing around like Blink 182. He's not, you know, but if you look at the scene he came from, it perfectly matched with, you know, with the scene he came from. So there's never been any evidence that Kurt had ever tried to take his life in the past. So normally when we're seeing people who commit suicide, there have been attempts. And we should talk about Rome as well.
The whole grunge scene was also theater. It was meant to be Absolutely. Depressed. I mean, he wore like a coffee stained top while, you know, playing on stage, and didn't wash his hair and all that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly right. And it was all, you know, it was all people think, oh, Kurt didn't care about how he looked. He cared about how he looked. He crafted that image. And I'm not trying to, I mean, I think it worked perfectly. And maybe it's, you know, that thing where you just find the look that you feel comfortable in and you do that. But it's something he worked on. It certainly wasn't, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, even if he was suicidal, the whole gun argument doesn't really work, but there are other smoking guns too, aren't there?
Yes. You know, so we talk about things like, let's talk about, you know, the suicide note. The whole premise of the suicide note is, I'm not having any fun anymore. I want to quit Nirvana, basically. And we know he was quitting Nirvana. So they had dropped out of Lollapalooza. And we know that he just wasn't enjoying it anymore. He was going to try and do something solo. So that was something that he was working on. So the whole thing is a love letter to his fans. It's addressed to Bada, who was his childhood imaginary friend. And he's just, it reads a bit like a journal entry, but, you know, basically, I love you, you know, I'm just not having any more fun doing this, but, you know, I appreciate you, and I feel like, you know, I'm just not being a good steward of this gift that I've been given of this fame. You know, I'm going out there and I'm playing shows and I'm not having any fun, and I know you can tell, and I can tell, and I just need to not do it anymore. So that's basically the end. And then there are four lines written in what we believe is different handwriting. And we've had the note assessed now by two handwriting experts. And the bottom four lines of the note basically say, to Courtney and Francis, I love you so much. I'll always be at your altar. You know, basically, I just can't do this anymore. Love, Kurt Cobain. Now, when you sign a note to your family, do you write your first and your last name on it? Is that something that, I mean, it's a very strange way to phrase a suicide note, to end a suicide note. And the handwriting is markedly different. Like if you looked at it, you would definitely say, oh, that is not the same handwriting. So like I said, the Seattle police say it's not the same handwriting because he just wrote the last four lines really quickly. We know that that's not true. There was a practice note. Courtney had forged other documents. I will allege that Courtney has forged other documents because we believe we have proof that she's forged other things of Kurt's in the past. There was a practice note found that Courtney had been practicing Kurt's handwriting as well. And that was found in her backpack that she'd left at her lawyer's house. So her and Kurt shared the same entertainment lawyer. And that lawyer has also stated she does not think Kurt was suicidal, does not think Kurt took his own life, and that she found that practice note in Courtney's bag when Courtney accidentally left it there. I mean, if you talk about this kind of evidence on a case, it never should have been ruled a suicide. All we're asking is that it gets reopened and relooked at in an unbiased way, because there are things that just don't make sense.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Courtney also tried to make things difficult for you.
We had a copyright infringement on our Patreon, and that was taken down. And when we looked into the LLC, it looked like it waffled back and forth between Francis's ownership and Courtney's ownership. We do know some people in the Cobain family, and we have been told that it was not Francis. She had nothing to do with it. So we believe that, yes, Courtney did try to get certain things shut down. But, you know, I think she feels that this is just going to be another, we're going to go away. And the thing is, it's, you know, we have an international team of people working on this. We have a forensic scientist. We have a fantastic lawyer. We're doing this the legal way. And I don't think anyone's ever had any money to put behind this. And we're doing that. So we're not going away. So anyone, you know, Courtney or anyone on her team that may watch this, you know, you might want to come forward now because none of us are going anywhere.
I haven't actually thought about Frances. How old is she now? She must be like 30.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, she is 30 and she just had a wee baby. So,
Frances,
so she's,
what's her surname now?
Cobain. Hawk. She's married to Tony Hawk's son, Riley.
That I did not know.
Yeah. Isn't that great? So, I mean, from what we've heard, again, this is, I'm not stating this as fact. Frances does not have a relationship with Courtney at this point in her life. She wasn't at Frances's wedding to Riley Hawk. And I just hope that Frances is doing well with her, you know, her baby. I think the Hawk family is a lovely family, and I'm sure that you know she's able to heal. We have to remember how this poor, beautiful child grew up and who this person was. Even if you don't believe that Courtney, you know, murdered Kurt or had him murdered, this is not a stable person. So we have to remember, you know, how Frances grew up.
What do you think Frances thinks?
I don't know. Frances never says, she doesn't, when she writes posts about Kurt, she talks about his death. She does not say murder, but she doesn't say suicide. I think no matter how strange your relationship is with your mother or father, to think that they have murdered your, you know, the other portion of your family is possibly too devastating to fathom. I hope that we can, you know, bring some peace to Frances. I would love Frances to know that her dad would never leave her like that, you know, because I truly don't believe. I mean, if we, you know, we can't talk about his mental state because none of us were there. I don't believe he would do that, but the forensics, you know, they prove that he didn't. So I'm hoping that brings some peace to Frances as well.
And then there's another bombshell, a gentleman by the name of Joe.
Yeah, Joe Burns. Joe Burns has been talking about this for about 5 years. And, you know, he's been basically telling the same story since about 2019. Joe Burns was a good friend of Kurt's. He was a tattoo artist. And he was also in a band called Aspirin Feast. And Kurt was actually a fan of Joe's band. And so Joe played drums in Aspirin Feast. They kind of had some revolving members. But they met through their mutual friend Dylan Carlson, who again is who Joe alleges ended up, you know, being with Kurt in his final moments. And so they ended up becoming fast friends. They talked about, you know, all sorts of things. They were both into sort of like different, you know, aspects of history, philosophy. Of course, they loved music. So Joe said that he was hanging out at the Lake Washington house when Kurt got back from Exodus. I mean, it was kind of like anybody would, you know, all their friends would just go hang out there. It's a huge house. There's always food. It's always kept clean. I mean, of course you would go hang out there. So Joe was there, and he was there with his girlfriend, Bonnie. And then Callie, Michael DeWitt, was there as well. Callie was the Cobain nanny. So Frances and her mother were in LA. Courtney was, we'll say, pretending to do, you know, she sent Kurt to rehab, but she said she was going to do her own detox in a posh LA hotel room, the Peninsula. So Courtney's out there at the Peninsula, what we believe was trying to create an alibi. And then, so like I said, Joe, Bonnie, Callie, Michael DeWitt, the nanny, they were all hanging out there. There was another girl there named Jennifer Adamson. Jennifer is the half-sister, was the half-sister of the Culkin boys, so Macaulay and Kieran. She was their half-sister, and she was a friend of Bonnie's at the time, so she hung out with Kurt a lot. Jennifer died under strange circumstances in 2002, I believe, as well. So she's unfortunately not here to speak to any of this. But so they were all hanging out, doing tattoos, you know, just, you know, doing what you do. They were doing some drugs. At some point, Dylan came in with somebody that Joe didn't recognize. So they come in. He said it was really weird. The way the driveway curved at the Lake Washington house, you could see if anybody came up the driveway. There were no cars. So all of a sudden, Dylan was just there with this guy. Joe calls him the creeper. So we know that, you know, he kind of had a vibe about him, or so Joe says. Now, Kurt had been back from Exodus a few days. So we believe this happened on about April 4th to April 5th, the morning of April 5th, maybe, you know, 2-3 in the morning. Kurt had been back from his rehab for a few days after leaving of his own accord. And he had, you know, was coming down into the kitchen. He would grab a snack. He came in to get a frozen TV dinner, and he was kind of talking to Joe and hanging out. He handed Callie a tape of music that he had made. Callie was talking about starting a little independent label, and Kurt had a practice studio in his basement. So he had written some music, and he thought, you know, I'm going to give this to you, Callie, you know, for your indie label. you know, maybe I can do something on it just to help your label out type of thing. So he gives the tape to Callie. He's kind of talking to them. He eats his food. He's a little bit high at this point. So we know that he's, you know, he is using after he leaves Exodus, but he's, you know, he's making conversation. He's fine. A little bit later, you know, they're all kind of, it's a huge house, so they're all just kind of, you know, going back and forth. A little bit later, Joe sees Kurt, and he is so high that Joe is now getting, you know, slightly concerned because Kurt is no longer, you know, really being very verbal, etc. At that point, Dylan and this other guy have now come in, and Dylan tries to fast talk to get Kurt back up to the garage to do more heroin. And Kurt, he doesn't want to go. He's wants to stay in the kitchen. And Joe's thinking to himself, why the fuck would he go do more heroin? He can barely even function. So, you know, Kurt doesn't want to go. At some point, the second guy steps in and says, okay, fuck off, we're going right now. And they start manhandling up to the greenhouse. So they go up the kitchen, they go up the stairs, and they're basically pushing Kurt up the stairs to get him to go into the greenhouse. So they get into the greenhouse. Now, we don't know exactly how much time there is between when they manhandle Kurt up to the greenhouse and when Joe Burns hears the shotgun. We figure it was about 20 minutes. We know from the autopsy that Kurt had his last meal within 2 hours of dying. So, you know, we're piecing together about how long he was in the kitchen, in the house, and then goes up to the greenhouse. At this point, Bonnie, Joe's girlfriend, is getting, you know, very scared. Things are just being weird. Dylan's acting strange. We don't know what's going on. She doesn't know what's going on. She says, we got to go, Joe. We're like, we're not. We're leaving. And Joe's concerned because he knows Kurt is up there. He's not sure who this guy is or what's going on. So he's worried about his friend, but his girlfriend is, you know, very upset and wants to leave. So they start leaving and they go and they're standing out on the driveway. And that is when they hear the shotgun. And Joe said that the shotgun sounded a little bit different. So when they're out, you know, Joe and Kurt used to go shooting in the forest, you know, in the woods behind Kurt's house. These are, you know, a shotgun that isn't up against the hard palate of someone's, or the palate of someone's mouth. So, you know, he was hearing a shotgun, obviously, that was pressed against Kurt's mouth. And so they hear the gun, they get in Jennifer Adamson's car, Callie goes with them, and they all go spend the night at Jennifer Adamson's house. And then in the next few days, everybody is just talking, saying that Kurt's gone. No one comes out and says, oh, did you know Kurt was murdered, you know, 2 days ago? They're all just talking about, well, now we know Kurt's gone, you know, or Kurt's not here. Kurt's never coming back. We know Kurt can't do this, you know, so everybody seemed to know that Kurt was dead. And yeah. We know that we believe that Callie had some foreknowledge of, you know, the way Joe said Callie was acting, trying to, you know, kind of push everybody out of the house. And it seems like Callie had some foreknowledge of what was happening to Kurt as well. So, you know, we believe Callie was letting people know that Kurt was gone. Joe was also read the suicide note before Courtney read it on television I believe she read it on the 10th. But Courtney, after, you know, Kurt's found on the 8th, and then Courtney reads his suicide note. She did change a few lines in it, but she did read his suicide note on TV. But Joe says that he was privy to the suicide note prior to that.
Where were Courtney and Francis?
They were in LA, at the Peninsula. So we know Francis was there.
Okay, so Francis was with her mom.
She was with her, with Eric from Hole, and her mom and the nanny. So they were all in LA. You know, Courtney never watched Francis. So technically she was with her mom, but no, she was with the nanny. Now, Courtney, it's an interesting, you know, if we talk about sort of the conspiratorial side of it, we don't really have any proof that Courtney wasn't there. Yes, she was at the Peninsula and people did see her. It's not but she was just locked in her room. So when people saw her on the between the 4th and the 5th, we don't know that she wasn't in Seattle. We assume that she was at the Peninsula, but we, you know, they're private jets. We don't she was very well off. We don't know whether whether she took a trip to Seattle. There are witnesses who say they saw her in Seattle, but we haven't been able to really confirm anything at this point. So we believe she was at the peninsula and was not there, but there is always the chance that she did make the trip. You know, her attempt to kill Kurt in Rome failed. So, you know that she used to date Billy Corgan, Courtney, from the Smashing Pumpkins, right before Kurt. So, you know, Kurt was in Europe. He was finishing up a tour. He had bronchitis. He wasn't feeling well. So they canceled the rest of the shows. And Kurt was waiting for her to bring Francis there to meet him for their wedding anniversary on the 27th of February. And so he was waiting there. She was busy sleeping with Billy Corgan and shopping, so she didn't show up for their anniversary. When she did finally arrive, they were fighting. And all we know happened is the next day, Kurt is in the hospital in Europe, in Italy, having OD'd. So Courtney claims that she woke up and saw Kurt on the floor, fully dressed, with a note in his hand and money in his other hand. And the note, she later said, was not flattering. You know, he was basically telling her he was done. He wanted a divorce. He was leaving her. You know, we know she was sleeping with Billy Corgan at this point. And so the doctors pumped his stomach. She woke up at, you know, about 2:30 in the morning. Somehow Kurt doesn't make it to the hospital until 6 a.m. So we know that there's a big time gap in between when she found Kurt and when she actually had the front desk call the ambulance. So we don't actually know whether Kurt was taken by ambulance, because Pat Smear also says he drove Kurt to the hospital. So we're not 100% sure. What we know is that there was a big time gap in between when Courtney says she found him and when Kurt was there. So we think that she knew he was dead. Or thought he was dead, I'm sorry, because he technically was, and then they just managed to save his life. The other thing is that the Rohypnol, so he had apparently mixed Rohypnol and champagne. Now, most people know that Kurt wasn't a big drinker, and Rohypnol is, you know, a date rape drug, so people generally don't remember what happened. They said that he took about 50 Rohypnol, Courtney claims. Now, Rohypnol comes in a blister sealed package. You don't just pour it out of a jar and put a bunch in your mouth. You're opening every single blister package to take these. So that's a very conscious effort to take that much Rohypnol. Now, Kurt had never taken Rohypnol in the past that we know of. The prescription for Rohypnol is under Courtney's name. So we think, you know, Kurt may have taken a few Rohypnol and then some more may have found its way into his system. But they classified it as accidental. The doctor in Rome said that Kurt absolutely didn't try to commit suicide.
But, you take that many Rohypnols, but it's accidental.
Yeah. Well, you know, Courtney said it was 50. The doctor said it wasn't that many. So we don't know, but we think Courtney, you know, added a little. Whether Kurt took the Rohypnol in the first place, we don't know. But we believe that Courtney, you know, added more to his drink and then assumed he was dead. And at that point, when she thought he was sufficiently dead, she called, you know, got an ambulance there, or Pat took him to the hospital. But so, you know, the doctor said, we see a lot of suicidal patients, you know, and Kurt was not one of them. So they stated it was an accident. And Kurt did tell Joe that it was an accident as well. But whether Kurt remembers exactly what happened after being in a coma and, you know, being on all that Rohypnol, we don't know.
Do you think she had any involvement in his death?
Pardon me, I do. And there are 450 million reasons that I think that. When they got married, they signed a prenup. Courtney is actually a trust fund kid. So she had a small trust fund from one of her grandparents. And so whether she signed the prenup to keep Kurt from ever getting any money, should she get more famous, or if Nirvana didn't get his, I mean, by the time they got married, Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit was out. So I think we know that, you know, he was already going to be a pretty huge star, but they did sign that prenuptial, you know, it could have been just to make it look like she wasn't marrying him for his money, but regardless, she was going to not get much when they got divorced. And she told the lawyer, the same lawyer that found the practice sheet, I need you to find me a divorce lawyer, the nastiest one you can find. So it's very clear they were going to get divorced. Kurt had asked her to be taken out of his will and asked Rosemary, the lawyer, if they could get a divorce, if she could help him start filing for that. Now, again, of course, he passed before anything like that could go through. But, you know, Courtney, there were things in her name. So the house was in her name, et cetera. But, you know, the royalties to all of Nirvana's music, all of that went over to Courtney and to Francis once Kurt passed. So she had a lot of good reasons to get rid of Kurt.
I'll come back to her in a moment. Has Billy Corgan ever said anything about this?
He has. He thinks it's ridiculous. What's ridiculous? Does not the thought that Courtney would have Kurt killed. And, you know, I certainly have my own opinions about Billy Corgan. And I think he knows more than he's saying. And I think that he's always been a very good friend to Courtney. So
I wanted to make a really bad joke and say that Billy dodged a bullet.
He really did. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I may sit around and wonder, boy, I wish she had stayed with Billy. You know, but I'm not a huge Pumpkins fan. I like Smashing Pumpkins back in the day, but I've heard a lot of stories about Billy Corgan and what type of person he is, and I'm not, you know. It would have been a better relationship, I think. A better fit for the both of them.
Let's go back to Courtney. You said you have 450 million reasons. We don't have time for all 450 million, but
that's how much money she's... Yeah, I mean, that's how much money she made from Kurt's death. You know, there's a quote in her diary that, you know, and she said it more than once, that the only thing more valuable than a rock star is a dead rock star. So this was not something that Courtney, she's bright, she's duplicitous, and she, you know, she planned her entire career. You look at, I'm not sure if you've ever heard her sing, you know, live or play guitar live.
I don't like her music. I think she sucks.
And she's not a good musician. And so, I mean, to craft the kind of fame that she did, you know, takes skill, she's very media savvy. You know, we still have issues getting things out in the media due to lawyers and which is kind of shocking in this day and age. You know, we see what happened with Diddy, et cetera, and we're still struggling to get, you know, media, you know, mainstream media out. So, but, you know, she, there's also, you know, some people, she did not want people to think that, you know, she had done anything wrong. She basically wanted to take Kurt's fans. So she thought that with Kurt, you know, Kurt dying, she would be able to charm Nirvana fans into, well, she's the next best thing. We're going to, you know, go see Hole play. We're going to do that. Hole's album came out about 6 days after Kurt died. Which is, you know, Live Through This, which is also a very apt title for her album. But, I mean, she only gained from Kurt's death, you know. And Kurt's mom, before she died recently, you know, she said that Courtney killed her baby. And, you know, she was there through a lot of that. And I think, you know, it's been said that Courtney threatened one of her other children. Whether that's true, we don't know, but we do know that Courtney, you know, Wendy was told things and saw things that she didn't share until closer to her death.
So if she, let's assume she was at the Peninsula that night, mm-hmm. That could have also just been cleverly set up. Do you think that this particular evening was D-Day, or was it just a comedy of errors because they were high and all sorts of things happened?
That's a great question. She had set it up. So interestingly, there were a few ruses that she planned where she was going to get arrested for drugs so that she had an airtight alibi when Kurt died. And she did get arrested in that week. So she thought that was going to be the day that Kurt, you know, that Kurt was killed. So we think that she basically just said, you know what? I don't know, whatever day, find him and kill him. We know that she also hired a private detective. That's another whole podcast we could do, because we're not 100% sure whether this private detective was... He kept working for Courtney about a year after she hired him to find Kurt. And he believes Kurt was murdered, but there are some very strange issues with his story. So when the Dylan thing, when we found out about Dylan, and I want to let everybody know that Dylan Carlson, somebody prior to Joe, and we didn't know this, but prior to Joe, someone else said that Dylan and one of his hitman friends tried to kill his best friend. So these stories that we're finding out about Dylan, this is not, you know, someone like you or me where people might be surprised that we would turn on a friend. These are all, of course, allegations. I have no proof of any of them, but we know, you know, we're getting a better sense of who people believe Dylan is. So Dylan, this PI who was hired, doesn't believe Joe's statement, and he really tries to gatekeep the case. So anybody new who starts working on it, he tries to discredit them immediately because he wants to be the only person who's ever been working on the Cobain case. And unfortunately, he's been working on it for 30 years with absolutely no progress. So we wonder why is he not making any progress? He's had the autopsy since 2012. Why has the autopsy not been given to medical examiners like we've done? Why, you know, the bullet trajectory, figuring out how Kurt was holding the gun. Why is he not looking into any of that? He basically just writes his little manuals and sells those on his website and tries to discredit anybody else's evidence. So when Joe came forward and said it was Dylan, this PI said, no, it wasn't Dylan. I can prove Dylan wasn't there. Now, to be able to prove Dylan was not there at Kurt's death, you have to know exactly when Kurt died. Now, this PI was not hired until April 3rd. So Kurt left Exodus on April 1st, and then this PI was hired. So he shouldn't even have any knowledge of where Dylan was 2 days prior to, because he wasn't hired at the time. And then you go, we don't know exactly what time Kurt died. It could have been the 3rd. It could have been the 4th. It could have been the 5th. We're still working on getting a medical examiner's second opinion, but because Kurt was cremated so quickly after his death, you know, and the autopsy report isn't very detailed, you know, it's a little bit difficult to determine exactly when he died. The medical examiner did say the 5th, and Joe said he thinks it was the 4th or the 5th. But what you're telling me is this PI knows where Dylan Carlson was every minute of every day after Kurt left Exodus. And that's just not, I mean, that's not feasible. And also, you know, to imply that he would never even talk to Joe. He just wrote him off wholesale. And I don't know about you, but I think every witness should be talked to. Even if he didn't believe Joe as a witness, there could be a nugget in there. Joe was there. We know that. Many people have put Joe there. They've put him, they know that Joe knew Kurt. So, you know, even if there are questions, we need to understand that Joe has valid information to give, and that's what really made me think, okay, well, this PI is, there's something strange going on here.
Okay, but Michelle, why did Joe wait so long?
I think if you watch Joe's interview, you'll kind of tell that he has some major PTSD.
I have watched it.
Yeah. He, you know, he feels a lot of guilt for what happened to Kurt. He was not able to save him. I mean, I know he thinks that he should have done more. I know he thinks that he, you know, could have gone up there and done something. I mean, they had a shotgun. I don't think that is, I don't think he's being fair to himself, but, you know, I think he tried to put it out of his mind. He's been a user, you know, off and on for 30 years. So I assume that what happened to Kurt has also, you know, affected him mentally. And so he's tried to block it out as much as he can. And he was doing well in the past 5 years. Bringing all this back to light has I think it's made his struggle more difficult. So I can't tell you, but I also can tell you that he was never questioned by the police. They wrote it off as a suicide. Nobody who was at the house was ever questioned. They wrote it off as a suicide, and Joe doesn't love the police. You know, he has had, you know, some issues with, of course, drugs, nothing ever violent or major, but, you know, he's had some drug issues, et cetera. So he's not exactly a fan of walking into a police station and going, hey, I know this thing about a closed case that you're not interested in. So
do you think there was any higher level involvement like FBI?
I don't. And maybe I don't think that because if there is that type of involvement, then anything we're doing would be moot. Because I don't, you know, I think that's something that that would be very difficult for our team to sort out. I don't feel like there's you know, if we look at who gained from it, we know that Courtney gained the most. You know, Geffen obviously gained as well, but I have no reason to believe that anyone from Geffen was involved. You know, Courtney's the one who wrote out the practice sheet. You know, I mean, Joe said Courtney basically, well, you know what, I should be fair, Joe didn't say that, but he did say that Courtney took care of certain people after it was done. So, you know, we believe that all the evidence points to a simple wife murdering her husband for money.
Who do you think actually pulled the trigger?
I think Dylan did.
Where is he now?
Dylan, he lives in Oregon, and he plays in his band Earth, and he's just living his life. So people have asked him on Instagram, of course, and there have been questions, and he says, I believe in freedom of speech, so, you know, I'm not going to sue anybody for defamation. But he says that he, you know, did not kill Kurt. We do know, we do have evidence that Dylan was there the day Kurt died, and that's one of the other reasons too. We have a somebody who knows a friend of Dylan's, and Dylan told them that he was there the night Kurt died. So we know that he was there. Of course, he didn't admit to that person that he had a part to play in his death, but we know Dylan was there. So, yeah.
What
so,
about neighbors?
So yeah, I believe Dylan. You know, nobody heard the shot. It's very strange because, you know, I
what?
Mean, we know.
A shotgun.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, in the Amityville story, I mean, that's obviously based on a true story. And he goes in and kills his whole family, 7 shots, and nobody hears it, right in Amityville, New York. So I don't know how that's possible. I'm not sure. But, you know, it was in the morning, we think 2 or 3 in the morning. So either people slept through it or, you know, you wake up and you're like, oh, did I hear something? But you're not sure. So I believe there is one lady who said down the street she thought she heard a shot, and it does match the time that we think Kurt was shot. But as for anybody going like, yes, we heard a ruckus and we heard a shot, and, you know. Now, the other thing is it is a low-powered rifle. So he had taken his own life with birdshot and a low-powered rifle. So, you know, he may have... It's not going to be as loud as a regular shotgun. And then, of course, it's in the in the hard pallet, which would have blocked out some noise, and in the greenhouse.
Have any of the other Nirvana band members spoken about this? Dave Grohl, for example.
No, but in his last, you know, he was very, very, he's called out Courtney many, many times for her atrocious behavior. Yes, Dave has. He has, in his last book, I believe, he does talk about the death of Kurt Cobain, and he says, he doesn't call it a suicide, and he says, yes, I have many questions. Whether that means questions pertaining to why Kurt did it or questions pertaining to there's some forensics here that don't make any fucking sense. I couldn't say. Chris Novoselic has been questioned about it many times. He's, he's just more accessible, I think, than Dave. And Chris has said the reason he believes Kurt committed suicide is only because he bought the shotgun. So if we can explain to Chris that, like, we don't actually know that Kurt bought that shotgun. You know, I mean, I think if somebody sat down with Chris and you know, could have a glass of wine and so, you know, because obviously this is very, very hard for Chris to hear and accept, I think Chris might be more open to it. When he sees the forensics, I think he'll have to sort of come to terms with it. And I hope it's a relief for Chris because, you know, I think he still harbors a lot of, I mean, so much grief. And, you know, he always says Kurt just shouldn't have done that. You know, to take that away from Chris's soul, I think would be a beautiful thing to know that, you know, in one way, of course, he's going to feel guilt that he wasn't able to protect Kurt. But in another way, I think, you know, he's going to know that wasn't something Kurt did.
How old, again, was Kurt?
Kurt was 27.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the so he's question. In the 27 club. Yeah. I mean, and Courtney really loved that idea. She thought that was, you know, she brought that up many times. And, you know, there are numerous interviews about her, you know, Kurt just saying he was going to go out in the 27 club. And you know, these are all after Kurt's death. I want to be very clear that there is never any mention of Kurt thinking about committing suicide, talking about committing suicide prior to his death, besides the one where he talks about his stomach pain. But everything else is all framed by Courtney and the media after Kurt is already dead. So, for example, saying Rome was a suicide attempt, No one said that until after Kurt died a month later. And now instead of an accident, it was a suicide attempt. So all of these things, you know, again, we're talking about someone who had never tried to commit suicide before. So, you know, we're looking at the way the media and Courtney, who's so media savvy, how she frames things after he dies.
If you could summarize everything into like a soundbite, what would you say?
I would say that, you know, Kurt was the reluctant voice of our generation. You know, he kind of spoke for us and how we were feeling in the early 90s. And now it's our turn. We have the forensics and we need to speak for Kurt. Because we know, you know, there. I do. I think it's going to get reopened. We're doing things the legal way. Of course, we're trying to put as much media pressure on it as possible. So I hope that everyone who watches this, you know, supports it, you know, take a look at the forensics that we're putting out and, you know, really. It's all there. You know, but please share it with people because, you know, we're having a bit of a media blackout. We can't get anything past the lawyers, but, you know, and we're going to get this reopened. And when it gets reopened, we're going to need that media pressure to make sure that the SPD doesn't open it and then just go, oh, we looked, nope, suicide, and shut it again. But it is going to get reopened. Absolutely.
And who do you think will be held accountable? Dylan and perhaps Courtney?
I hope so. And I assume that one of them will probably, you know, I think there are enough people who know that someone's going to take a plea deal, get immunity, and then say who exactly the other person was there with Dylan. You know, there will definitely be money trails. There are money orders. There are, you know, things like houses being purchased, you know, places for people to stay. I think that we'll find out who the other person was as well. And I hope all three of them are held accountable for what they've done. And I just want to say super quick, you know, there are 68 copycat suicides that we know about. People, children who have taken their own lives because they believe Kurt committed suicide. And they think if my idol has nothing to live for, what the hell am I doing? We had a copycat suicide 2 years ago. So people are still committing suicide because they believe Kurt Cobain committed suicide. And we need to put a stop to that. And we need to take Kurt's narrative back for him as well. He did not, the things that Courtney has, the media have, and Courtney have made people believe Kurt was a whiny, entitled little brat who didn't appreciate his fame. And, you know, did the ultimate sort of, I think people will say the ultimate selfish thing by taking himself out when he had a small child. And that's not what happened. And that's not who Kurt was.
Nirvana really was an influential band. There's no doubt about that.
Absolutely. Still, how many t-shirts do you see? I see a few Nirvana t-shirts every week. You know, no Beatles. No, like, I mean, you know, well, maybe a Beatles t-shirt every once in a while. But Nirvana, they're never going anywhere.
Michelle, how can I keep up with all of this?
You know, we have a YouTube. Our YouTube is Who Killed Kurt, and our website is whokilledkurt.org. You know, we're working on getting all the copycat suicides up there, etc. But we do have all the Seattle police files. We have everything up there. And on our YouTube, we go through all of the forensics and why, you know, we know that it's not scientifically possible that Kurt use that shotgun on himself, and why we actually believe Kurt was dead before the shotgun went off. So, and we're, you know, we're very open to people when they ask questions on our YouTube. We generally write back, you know, if they're questions about, you know, if they're not trolls, we always write back. So if anyone has any questions, please feel free to reach out to us.
Smells like Kurt spirit.
Absolutely. I know. I think smells like murder is the is exactly right. So, yeah.
Michelle Wilkins, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so lovely to talk to you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.